Chapter 13, Triumph and Illusion. I headed to the Oval Office late on the morning of November 3, 2004. I was expecting to witness the president receiving a concession call from his re-election opponent, Senator John Kerry. It had been a long night. Even the usually early-to-bed Bush had stayed up until 5 a.m., about the time he typically would awake, and was operating on about 2 hours' sleep. I had left the White House around 5:30 a.m. and returned a few hours later. The day before had reminded me a bit of Election Day 2000, only this time the drama centered on Ohio, not Florida. In the late afternoon, just before polls around the country started to close, the mood was grim. The President and Mrs. Bush had voted in Crawford and then stopped in Ohio before Air Force One transported them and their daughters and those of us on the senior staff with him back to Washington. Before we jumped into the staff vans to take us back to the White House, Dan Bartlett heard from Karl Rove, who had received word from the president's chief pollster, Matthew Dowd, that exit polls spelled trouble for the president. The grim diagnosis left all of us in the upper echelons of Bush world feeling anxious. But by evening, our mood had begun to change. When results in states like South Carolina and Virginia started coming in, it was clear the exit polls were off base. Things were tight, but seemed to be tilting our way. Cautious optimism permeated the atmosphere. I alternated between my West Wing office and the adjacent Roosevelt Room, which had been set up for the senior staff victory watch party. My wife Jill and I, we'd been married the previous November, enjoyed visiting with former President George H.W. Bush for several minutes when he popped in to say hello to the assembled advisors. Jill, who had never met him personally, was thrilled to talk with the warm, gracious, elder statesman. The current president was following the news from the private residence in the White House with immediate and extended family, parents, siblings, and their spouses, as well as several longtime friends. Later, I headed over to the old family dining room, just below the private residence, which Karl Rove had arranged to use as the election night war room. It was conveniently located just a staircase away from the president if he decided to check in personally. He did just that several times during the evening, while maintaining continuous contact with Carl by phone. On one side of the room were tables with several computers where staffers, including Rove, could monitor state-by-state results. On the other were large flat-screen TVs tuned in to the network political coverage. The original plan was to limit access to the room to a few key political aides, Rove, his top assistants Israel Hernandez and Susan Ralston, and a handful of others. But as the night progressed and the election race continued neck and neck, some other senior White House staff arrived to get the up-to-the-minute scoop about where things were headed. I was one. Near midnight, the network started calling Florida for Bush. The old family dining room was filled with cheers and excitement. Although the numbers-crunching Rove felt we had won Ohio too, none of the stations were close to calling it yet. Andy Card had already begun reaching out to the Kerry campaign, delicately taking its pulse and gently encouraging them to consider making the dreaded concession call. A victory party was underway in the atrium of the Ronald Reagan building just down the street. At the White House, we were all hoping that we'd soon be able to celebrate and watch the president give a victory speech. But still, the night dragged on. The wee hours of the morning arrived and the national networks, perhaps overly cautious after having been badly burned in 2000, were still hesitating to call Ohio with its crucial cargo of electoral votes. As we headed into the 4 a.m. hour, we felt that our cushion of about 150,000 votes in Ohio would give us the state and the election. But the networks were still holding back, and Kerry and some in his campaign were still holding out hope that Ohio's provisional ballots would somehow turn it around. At the White House, a few advisors wanted Bush to declare victory without a concession by Kerry. They hoped this move would discourage Democrats from bringing in the lawyers and turning 2004 into a new version of 2000. But others urged Bush to wait, and that's how matters stood when the president called it a night and headed up to the residence at 5 a.m. Word had filtered back to us confidentially via Mike McCurry of the Kerry campaign that if we just gave Kerry some time to reflect, he would come around. Later that morning, he did. When I arrived back at the White House that morning, after a couple hours of rest, I immediately popped into the Oval to see the president. "Congratulations, sir," I said. "Nice win." Thanks, Scott, Bush replied. You did a great job, a really great job. A little later, Rove, Karen Hughes, Dan Bartlett, Chief Speechwriter Mike Gerson, and I were visiting with the president in the Oval. We were expecting Kerry's call at any moment. Don Rumsfeld, grinning ear to ear, popped his head in briefly to congratulate the president. At 11:02 a.m., Bush's assistant, Ashley Estes, appeared. Mr. President, Senator Kerry is on the line. The president walked back to his desk to sit down and pick up the phone. We could only hear Bush's side of the conversation. I think you were an admirable, worthy opponent. You waged one tough campaign. I hope you're proud of the effort you put in. You should be. When Bush hung up after 3 or 4 minutes, he said, slightly choking up, "That was very gracious." Then he started to tear up. It was a sentimental moment. Bush had secured a place in history by winning a coveted second term. He started hugging each of us as our eyes also began to well up. The embraces were warm and heartfelt. Within minutes, Andy Card arrived to join the hug fest, along with Joe Hagan, Blake Gottesman, and Ashley. Bush then went down the hall to the vice president's office, and the two congratulated each other. Mrs. Bush called just after he left, and a short time later, Bush went to the residence to see her and get in a workout before his afternoon victory speech. I remember pulling up underneath the Reagan building in the motorcade that afternoon for the celebration. The staff vans were packed full with joyful senior staff. This was a time for us to enjoy the moment of euphoria we'd been deprived of 4 years earlier. Inside, the building was packed with cheering supporters and staff. Bush's remarks were brief. He thanked his supporters and staff, singling out a few, like the architect, Karl Rove, and reached out to those who supported his opponent. He talked about the record turnout and the historic victory. And then he turned to the agenda for a second term. "Because we have done the hard work, we are entering a season of hope," he said. He pledged to build on the recent economic progress, reform the tax code, strengthen Social Security, and continue improving public schools. He also reaffirmed a commitment to helping the emerging democracies in Iraq and Afghanistan, and to continuing the war on terrorism. Befitting the occasion, it was an upbeat, hopeful speech, filled with expectation about the great accomplishments he looked forward to during his second term. The next morning, Dan held a communications team celebration in the Roosevelt Room. The president made a brief surprise visit to thank everyone for their work. As he finished, he gave me a shout-out. "Where's Scott?" he asked. "Is he here?" Some others pointed to me. "I especially want to thank Scott," Bush continued. "Scott did a great job. You didn't make any news," he added in his jocular mood. "I want to thank you for saying nothing." The line got the chuckle it deserved, but it also reflected Bush's sentiment about not wanting his press secretary stirring up controversy unnecessarily, particularly in the heat of a campaign. He'd used a similar line at R.A. Fleischer's departure party, saying he'd done a great job of saying nothing at all. Mid-morning, Bush held a cabinet meeting. "I expect there to be lots of rumors and speculation about changes in the cabinet for our second term," he began. "Well, a few changes are very likely, but I haven't had time to think about them yet." Then he talked about the second term agenda. He talked about the Medicare prescription drug benefit, soon to go into effect, and the need to make sure that the projected savings for seniors became real and true. On the domestic front, education had helped Bush win the election, neutralizing a typically Democratic issue, or even turning it into a Republican strength, he said, "because we have a vision and philosophy." The second term would be a chance to solidify Bush's place in history. Retooling Democratic ideas of education, Medicare, and Social Security along conservative lines could take away Democratic dominance on these core issues for years to come, or so Bush and Karl Rove believed. With Republican majorities in the House and Senate, the two men, especially Rove, relished the prospect of launching a new era of Republican dominance as part of their legacy. The president told the cabinet he would push for medical liability reform, insist on fiscal discipline, seek an energy bill, and then turn to the three biggest domestic initiatives: Social Security, tax reform, and budgetary reform. Most important, Bush indicated that his approach to governing would be much the same as it had been during his first term. The permanent campaign would continue. "How we sell the big items is going to be very important as we move forward," Bush declared. We already sold the American people on the agenda, he added, referring to the election victory. Now, he assured the cabinet when it came to promoting his biggest agenda items, we are going to go for it. The focus would be on swaying public opinion and thereby pressuring Congress to get on board. It was a philosophy of governance he shared with the powerful Rove, to whom he now turned. Bush praised Rove as a brilliant architect who'd come up with a perfect strategy for the re-election and had run a perfect campaign. It was incredibly well managed. We had huge, magnificent crowds. It went without saying that the architect would now be turning his attention to running the campaign to sell the big items to the American people. It was as if Election Day merely represented a way station on a never-ending journey.